Your cell door opens, and the Duke collapses to the ground. He's shivering. He crawls into the corner, locks himself into the fetal position, and cries. The other prisoners are quiet, staring at the wavering form. The soldiers rush in. One of them grabs you by the neck, while another pulls your arms behind your back. It's time, a tall, thin man says. He's dressed in priest's robes and wears a skull cap. You try to remember the advice you gave the Duke, but your heart is racing too fast. The adrenaline is pumping hard through your veins. You can't think of what you're supposed to do, how you're supposed to calm yourself. You feel an overriding drive to escape. You're led to a room full of torture instruments and the poor souls who are trapped within them. Everything is lit by a dim, flickering torchlight. There's a prisoner being turned on the wheel over hot coals. There's a man hanging by his stomach from a giant hook. There's a prisoner being stretched on a rack. There are so many torturous scenes, each with its unique script of private hell. The world begins to spin, and you feel yourself losing consciousness. You hope this means you'll be removed from this world by the Twilight Histories, but you're not. You're still here. The soldiers take your arms and drag you from the landing down the stairs. The priest leads you through the maze of horrors, weaving the whole length of the room as though to give you a tour. Each time you pass a new horror, you try to look away, but the images burn into your mind. Limbs being removed, eyes gouged out, spikes driven into flesh. You recognize many soldiers from the Duke's campaign. Priests demand confessions as they write in their books. Men beyond agony speak in bursts of syllables. You hear pleading names of families back home, babies unborn, wives, mothers, fathers. There are prayers and pledges of undying allegiance to the Emperor Pope. There is the renunciation of Satan and the praise of God. There is crying and wailing and sobbing and screaming, all melding together in your mind in a swirling chorus of macabre suffering. You're led into a room and the door closes behind you, the sounds muffled. You're alone with the priest, or is he an inquisitor? He walks behind a wooden table and sits. At the edge of the table is a simple candelabra that illuminates the room, its candles low and the wax pooling on the wood of the table. The priest opens a large, leather-bound book and taps his quill in the inkwell. Shall we begin?
Yes, of course.
You try to collect yourself. Your heart is still racing. You are breathing shallow. You must get a hold of yourself. Focus. Raise your consciousness from your body to your brain. Rational thoughts. The room. You're thankful to be in a room without any signs of torture instruments. You're thankful the door is thick, muffling all but the most piercing screams. Time. Precious time. You must savor this. How long will this last before you're back in the chamber of agony beyond the door?
First, let us establish who you are. I understand you are not in the tax registry for New Munich. Where do you come from?
The Old World.
Where, exactly?
Hedeby.
A Viking?
Yes.
You don't look like a Viking.
Well, I am from Hedeby.
Who are your parents?
I was adopted, so I don't know anything about my birth parents.
Who are your adopted parents?
Oh, what I mean is, I don't have parents.
Who raised you?
It was an orphanage.
An orphanage at Hedeby? I've never heard of such a thing.
It was small.
What else can you tell me about Hedeby?
What do you want to know?
Answer the question, please.
Anything? It's a Viking town, good walls, a port city. How about something personal? I don't understand. An impression, something that could prove you lived there. Oh, I spent a lot of time in the streets, so I guess the cobbles?
The cobbles?
Yes, I remember the feel of the cobbles under my feet. That's a personal memory. The priest looks down at his ledger and writes for a time. There's a pause in the muffled screams beyond the door, and the sounds of the scratching quill and sputtering flame rush in to replace them.
Why did you leave, Hedeby?
I was trying to recruit some Vikings to return home.
Why?
I have heard the Black Scourge is on the move again. Hedeby is my home.
And when did you come to New Munich?
Maybe a few months ago. It was summer.
The first record I have of you is regarding the murder of a priest. Can you explain that?
I was in the room, but I didn't do it.
Who did?
I think it was... Trail off. Should you name him? Poor Atwana. He's Hiawatha's cousin and a good young man. He's held a heavy conscience after killing the priest, even though all his friends and family showed him support.
Yes,
the Inquisitor says, leaning in. You could name one of the fallen men. You saw a few of Hiawatha's friends skewered by the knights. But how could you know the survivors would corroborate your story? You hadn't talked this through with them.
I don't know his name, you say. You were with him. How can you not know?
I'm bad with names.
But you'd recognize his face. It was one of the Skraelings.
I don't believe I know them well enough. The Inquisitor leans back.
We already know who he is. The other Skraelings told us. But I'd like you to say his name. Get into the practice of speaking the truth to me. You are a vessel that is polluted, and I am here to help you remove that stain from your soul. But I can only help you if you are completely honest with me. Do you understand?
Yeah, I get how this works.
Search your mind. See if you can come up with a name.
Their names are hard to pronounce.
Were there any distinguishing features that could help us identify him, his body shape, or a feature on his face?
Dark skin. He's a little heavyset, I think, but not too big. Maybe that's just my imagination. I really don't know them all that well. They keep to themselves. You'd probably do better to ask them.
Let's be specific. Would you say he's full-faced or thin?
I don't know. Maybe in between.
And his teeth? Are any teeth chipped or missing?
I really can't remember.
Let me change the line of questioning. Why were you there? Why were you in the room with them when he murdered the priest?
It's a long story.
We have time.
Well, if you must know, my employer kidnapped one of their kids. So the Skraelings kidnapped me. They tried to get me to talk. I had a hunch the priest took the boy, so we went to look there.
And the Skraelings murdered the priest. Why?
Because we walked in on the priest, buggering a young boy. The Inquisitor looks down at his book and scribbles something. He's frowning now. The last thing you want to do is offend this man. He is a priest, after all.
You did not try to stop the man from murdering the priest. Why?
I didn't have a chance. It happened so quickly. And besides, the Skraelings were armed and I wasn't.
Did you know they were going to murder the priest?
No, of course not.
Why would you say, of course not?
I was in a tough spot. They kidnapped me. They didn't tell me what they were going to do, just that they wanted information.
Was the boy you saw the priest buggering... Was that the Skraeling boy who had been kidnapped?
No.
But they killed the priest anyways.
Again, it happened so fast. There were a lot of emotions. They probably saw it and were so disgusted.
Did they know the boy? Was it a Skraeling boy?
No. He was blonde-haired, I believe.
Did you find the Skraeling boy at the church?
Yes, down in the crypt. There were many other boys down there, too, all tied up.
You said you had a hunch about the priest. Tell me about that.
You can't tell the priest you took a drug from a shaman and had a vision. You don't want him thinking you were possessed by demons.
You know, I can't say why. I had a feeling.
No, you know what it was? I was collecting clothes, and one day the priest gave me some boy's clothes. I found that strange. Also, he had a kind of boy-loving look about him, if you know what I mean.
So, because you had a hunch, you directed a band of wild Skraelings, armed and bloodthirsty, to the door of a church, where they killed a priest, a representative of the Emperor Pope.
Well, it turned out to be true, didn't it? My hunch was right.
You feel a smile forming on your lips, but quickly suppress it. The Inquisitor is not happy with you. You have to reduce yourself, give him a confession of guilt to show you admit wrongdoing.
You know, I get it. I led them to the priest. He was the Pope, the Emperor Pope's representative at New Munich. I can see how that looks bad.
It looks very bad. Very bad indeed. Let me be clear. Your actions led directly to the death of the Emperor Pope's emissary to New Munich. The priest was his eyes and ears, his representative, and therefore the representative of God himself. You rose in arms against his eminence. You are in deep, deep trouble.
What kind of trouble?
The Inquisitor looks down and writes. You wait in silence. He puts down his quill and leans into his chair. He takes a stone out of his pocket and bangs it twice on the table. The door opens, and with it, a flood of horrifying sounds. A soldier steps in.
The iron casket for this one,
the Inquisitor says and rises. The soldier grabs you by the arm. You're suddenly too weak to stop him, too weak even to walk. He has to drag you.
Standing erect against the wall is what looks like a casket made of old, tarnished iron. It's in the shape of a man, and there are two holes for eyes in the thick iron wall, the only holes visible on the whole surface. A soldier opens the casket, and it creaks on ancient hinges. A terrible smell hits you like a punch in the nose. The inside of the iron sarcophagus is riddled with hundreds of iron nails.
In you go,
a soldier says, and heaves you onto your feet. You gain enough strength to maneuver yourself around the nails. The casket is thrust shut. You scream, as much in shock as in pain. The Inquisitor appears in your eye holes. He looks in.
Survey the room. In time, you will experience each one of the torture instruments you see until you finally succumb. Learn them well. You have time, priest killer.
He leaves your view, and you're left watching a scene from hell. You spend what feels like days in the iron casket, dozing in and out of consciousness. Even the slightest movement induces sharp pain from the nails, and you're forced to stand, erect, as still as possible. The pain in your limbs is furious, but resting only drives the iron nails into your groin. Urine and bowel movements flow freely and create havoc on your nostrils in this confined space. And yet, eventually, you are consumed by hunger and thirst. You lick the iron nails, hoping for a little condensation from your breath. Meanwhile, your eyes and ears are forced to endure the torture of others on a spectrum so cruel it's beyond anything you had imagined. Instruments of torture have put human ingenuity to satanic use. There is no resting. Every moment that passes is a battle against an ever-increasing number of ailments. Crying does not help. In your exhaustion, you pray to every known god or spirit you've ever heard of. In a whirl of delusions, you even pray to the Twilight Histories, as though it were some sort of god. You concentrate on your chip and will it to suck you away from this world. You try to feel it. You speak to it. Plead with it. It is silent. You hallucinate. At first, you see windmills formed from your hunger. They're black and white and spin, obscuring the nightmarish images emanating through your eye holes. After a while, you see colors like a laser show. They mix with the windmills to form a kind of laser washing machine effect. You have strange thoughts. You discover you can take your thoughts and play with them like physical things. You take old guilts you have gnawed at, and you place them like spirits into the bodies of those being tortured. The guilt of betraying Hiawatha, you place it into a man being waterboarded. The choking screams are coming out not from the man, but from your own guilt being purged. You feel a sort of relief in this, a savage joy that makes you laugh out loud. Other guilts follow, guilts of murder, of leaving your family so many decades ago. You abandoned your parents and friends in some foolish quest for adventure and immortality. You put this guilt into men being hung, or sawn, or stretched. You have to laugh. How many decades have you lived now? And to die like this? Was it worth it? Of course not. It would have been far better to live a short, bland, and painless life back home. You wanted to live forever, comes a voice. Is it yours? It sounded real, not a voice in your head. Who's there? You say. Is someone there? You hear a rattle. Are you there? Snake? You say. I am here. Please, I know you're real. You showed me to the priest. Can you get me out of here? You wanted to live forever? I don't care about that. Not anymore, you say. I don't care about living forever. I'll die. I just don't want to die like this. Death is simply a transition you must push through. Push through to the other side. It's safe there. There is peace. I changed my mind. I don't want to die. There are two windmills. They move around each other. Their centers look like eyes. The face of the snake appears like a ghost as the eyes come to rest in its sockets. Death is life, and life is death. There is no difference. All is one. You must push through. Okay, okay, but I don't want to feel pain. If I must die, then can it be quick? Is that what you want? A quick death? Snake, I just want to get out of here. Can you help me? Out of here? Away? On a boat? Sailing on the water? The snake's face turns into a vision of a Viking longboat in full sail. You're filled with such a beautiful sense of freedom. I want to be on that boat, you say, but you are suddenly gripped by the feeling that it is the boat of death that will lead you to the underworld. You don't care. You give in. Life, death, if it looks like that, you'll take it. Hold on to this image, the snake says. You will be there soon enough. The iron casket is opened. You collapse into the arms of a soldier.
Oh, that's quite a smell, the soldier says and turns his face away.
He lays you on the ground. He pulls off your clothes. Another soldier appears with a bucket and dumps cold water on you. You lick and suck the ground, trying to get some of the water into your parched mouth. The soldier refills the bucket and tosses it at the iron coffin. Two soldiers grab you by the arms. They throw a coarse robe over you and drag you up the stairs to the Inquisitor's room.
How was your time in the iron casket? The Inquisitor says.
How long was I there for?
A week. 6 days, actually. We let you rest on the Sabbath. You look up at his face, ugly and swirling in a semi-hallucinatory way. You don't have the energy to talk. You can hardly hold yourself up on the chair.
Water, you say.
The priest walks into the shadows. You hear the sound of water pouring. He returns with an earthenware cup in one hand and a jug in the other. He offers you the cup, and you grab it and dump the water down your throat, almost vomiting. "More?" Inquisitor says. You wipe your mouth and nod, pressing the cup towards him. "Tell me about your sins," the Inquisitor says, while refilling your cup.
I sinned," you say, your eyes hungrily watching the water flowing out of the jug.
"How?"
I led some Skraelings to a priest, and they killed him.
Why was that such a grave sin?
Because the priest was the ambassador of the Emperor Pope.
Because the priest was the ambassador of God?
Yes, God. I sinned against God,
you say, and hold your hands out for the cup. He hands it back to you. This time you drink more slowly, savoring the taste.
Do you believe in God?
Yes.
Do you believe that the Emperor Pope is the direct channel through which God speaks to us on Earth?
Yes.
Do you understand that the Emperor Pope communicates God's message through his priests?
Yes.
Then you appreciate the severity of your crime.
Yes, I'm starting to see the logic.
Do you understand how deep this sin goes? It is one thing to be pressed into an army in revolt. The Duke carries much of the responsibility for this, though of course the stain of sin from this act of treachery runs down to you as well. Your Duke would like to have killed the Emperor Pope himself. Can you imagine the magnitude of the calamity that would have befallen humanity if he had achieved this? We would have lost our connection with God. We would have been severed from heaven and doomed to hell. The magnitude of that sin, even though your Duke failed to carry it out, is beyond. It is beyond. The Inquisitor is, for once at a loss for words, overtaken by the enormity of the thought.
Thank God he failed.
He crosses himself. The mere thought of sin is just as bad as carrying the sin out. However, I am deeply troubled by the killing of the priest. While you failed to sever the connection between man and God, you did slaughter a priest. And since the Duke failed to carry out his Satan-inspired desires, your crime is now the worst committed.
You are a priest,
you say. Inquisitor's face turns from exasperation to stone. I am of the Order. I am a servant of God.
The Skraelings killed one of your Order. That makes it personal to you.
He stares into your eyes, challenging you, trying to crush your will. You realize, staring back into those cold, dead eyes, that there is nothing you can do or say that will fix this. The priest is out for revenge. He leans forward.
Since you had a chance to view all of our instruments of torture, I'll let you pick the one you'll endure next.
His words fall down on you like a hammer. To calm your nerves, you try to think of the boat the snake showed you, its sail fluttering, the waves churning, the boat of death that will take you across the River Styx.
The saw?
The Inquisitor says. You will never forget that horrendous instrument. A man is tied upside down. Two large, sturdy men each take a handle. They place the blade on the victim's groin and work with him like a log. The poor victim screams until the blade cuts his heart.
No,
you say, more in a whisper.
Yes, you're right. That could end things too quickly. We'll save the saw for last. How about something slower? The rack?
An image of the rack flashes before your eyes. A man is lying on the bed. Torturers turn cranks until his arms and legs pop out of their sockets. Depending on whether the torturers want to end his life, they may choose to stop there, or keep going.
Not a bad one. It's fairly excruciating, but still a bit too damaging. We need to start slow so you can live to tour the widest number of instruments possible.
Oh, I know.
How about the hand screws? That's relatively light. You saw many men have their hands crushed, bones pulverized by the pressure of the screws. When they released the hands, there was often nothing left but pulp to the horror of their victims. The hand screws, then, he says, and bangs the rock on the table. You're strapped to a chair. There are leather bands around your waist, ankles, forearm, and biceps that lock you in place. A man sits opposite you. Though you can't see your hands through the black machinery, you can feel him placing each of your fingers through the holes, completely immobilizing your hands. He winds the screws with a wheel until you feel the cold iron on your fingertips. The inquisitor steps behind the operator. You've probably seen how this works. We begin by crushing your fingers at the nails and slowly work our way up until every bone is crushed. It's an ingenious piece of machinery. Every bone is isolated for maximum pain. The priest takes a sand timer and turns it upside down. We'll do this for an hour, nice and slow. When you're done, you can go back to your cell, and tomorrow, after you've had a rest, you can try another of our instruments. The sail flutters. Seagulls cry. You hear the sound of waves lapping against wood. Begin, the Inquisitor says. The door to the chamber opens with a bang, and a soldier runs in.
The executioner is here, he says.
The man operating your machine rises from his chair, as do all the other specialists and priests. Your Inquisitor looks at the door. A man enters. He's wearing rich clothes, out of place for the torture chamber, dark burgundy hose, a long coat embroidered with gold. He looks like a nobleman, not what you imagine an executioner would look like. He motions to the head inquisitor. You feel a rush of hope. Will he stop the torture? It's funny to feel hope at the sign of an executioner. Your priest's face is somber. He moves slowly, almost shuffling his feet. The executioner takes him by the arm and speaks with him in whispers, their backs turned. Then the Inquisitor storms off, his face stone with anger. That's enough for today, the executioner says. Everyone, back to your cells. You'll be given a good hot meal, beer, and new clothes. A doctor will treat your wounds. I'll be coming around to each of your cells to speak with you once you're well rested. The torture is over. You feel tears well in your eyes as the operator unlocks your hands from the screws. You pull each finger out and caress it, cherishing the movement. You join the line of prisoners in their slow, hobbled march down the dark halls, utterly happy.
I've been working with our new writer, Kevin Valbanese, on his first script, and it looks great. I won't give away too much, but if you're one of those listeners who has been begging me to take you to the Byzantine world, you won't be disappointed. Ships, islands, Byzantines, pirates, Normans, it's all coming to you next month. If we want to get Kevin on the payroll, we're going to need to grow by a very modest 3 new members each week. That's very achievable. If you want to be on the growth team, please visit twilighthistories.com and click on the page called Members. When you sign up, you're going to get access to a bunch of shows, such as Rome Industrial, the serial novel. I'll be posting Chapter 8 in a few days. You'll also get a show called Cleopatra Caesar. Have a listen to this 5-minute sample.
You've been sitting on the hard stone bench of the Arena Romulus for hours, watching the sickening sight of men and women fighting to the death. But these are not trained gladiators. These are the city's rich and famous. They are senators with white togas fringed with Phoenician dyes. They are women with delicately brocaded hair and long silk robes imported from China. They are young and old, stately and comely, rich and super rich. But all are, or were, slave owners, convicted for the crime of subjecting humanity to servitude. An elderly woman is led out of the dungeons. Her cane is taken, and she's given a spear. Her old legs wobble as she stumbles towards a starving black bear from the forests of Germania. The bear rushes at her, and she collapses just before being mauled. Two senators, one from the Metellus family, one a Scipio, are given the weapons of gladiators. They stand awkwardly in the arena, both unwilling to raise their weapons. Freed gladiators strut out and poke them with spears, edging them together. Metellus, a young man, raises his trident and rushes at Scipio. The elder statesman knocks it aside with his sword. They fight until the elder Scipio lies bleeding on the ground. A thumbs down from Draco the Greek forces Metellus to end the life of the famous senator. Metellus will live to fight again. A group of slave managers, all convicted of torture, abuse, and murder, are given a chance to save their lives. Hundreds of them are herded into the arena, each brandishing the weapons used against their slaves. Some have whips, others cat-o'-nine-tails. Others, more fortunate, are armed with axes, swords, or hammers. It is the more benign ones, the weaker ones, who die first. The larger, more ruthless slave managers battle on to the end in a heroic struggle that raises waves of bellowing pleasure from the 100,000-strong audience. Your dining room manager, finally dressed and unarmed, dies mercifully in the opening moments. A wealthy Indian family visiting Rome for the wedding enters the arena on an elephant. They face a group of senators dressed in legionary parade uniforms in a pathetic reproduction of the Battle of the Ganges, in which Caesar conquered the last of the Indian armies. The senators drag the family from the frightened elephant and kill them one by one. Princess Patella, the 18-year-old girl who was to marry Ptolemy, dies last, shielded to the end by her elderly father. On and on the matches go, fight after fight. Animals, men, women, blood dumps into the arena as though from a great aqueduct pumping out the entrails of an empire. No amount of sand can absorb it, and the sticky gore clings to the bodies of all who enter the ring. As the baking sun rises in the sky, the smell of blood and sweat mixes with the more putrid smells of bowels and stomach acids. The spectators at the top of the arena, closer to the cool breeze, are the lucky ones. Those who are ringside are bathed in the vapors of death, an intoxicating smell that makes eyes burn with hunger for more. Vendors wander the aisles, squeezing sacks of warm wine into thirsty mouths, like birds stuffing worms down the throats of screaming chicks. Men and women, drunk from alcohol and intoxicated by bloodlust, lose themselves in an ecstasy of death. At the end of a particularly gruesome fight between a nobleman and his mistress, Draco rises from his seat of honor, the seat where Julius Caesar once presided over the games, and motions for the arena to be cleared of bodies. Arena staff rush in from all sides to drag out the corpses. Some scoop entrails and guts into bins, while others pour fresh sand over pools of congealing blood. Soon, a cloud of dust fills the ring.
Friends, citizens, soldiers of the revolution, It is time for the main event.
Hushes, murmurs fill the arena as Draco pauses for dramatic effect.
Bring out Cleopatra.